Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, welcome to another Word in Your Ear podcast. Now, a lot of big record labels in the 60s and 70s had a wide variety of artists, but no specific identity. But there was one in particular that made every act it signed seem impossibly hip and characterful and charismatic, and that was Island. And much of that was down to the man with the vision to start it and run it for 30 years, who's just published an absolutely wonderful memoir called The Islander, Chris Blackwell. Chris, welcome aboard.
Wow. Hi.
Great. Hi. So you're in Jamaica, where you lived for so much of your life and which features so much in the book. You're there now, aren't you?
I'm in north coast of Jamaica.
Are you in Goldeneye, the estate that I think you bought from your family bought from Ian Fleming?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Well, it's now a place that people come and visit and come and stay. It's a hotel, really.
Fantastic. Well, look, you were born in the UK and you moved to Jamaica very young, and you have this, in the book, it describes this idyllic life, lots about your mother, various family friends, Errol Flynn, Noel Coward, Ian Fleming. Can you give us any memories of those three people in particular?
Well, they all obviously sort of stood out. Noel Coward was incredibly funny. When he was talking at all, you know, he had incredible sense of humor. So it was just fascinating going and listening to him and hanging around. We didn't hang around in those days. You just sort of walked around sipping some rum drink or something like that. He was hilarious. He was incredibly funny. You'd have to leave the room because you're getting pain from, you know, when you laugh too much, you get a pain. So he was like that. Then you'd come back and he was back again in another character.
And Errol Flynn, you described as the first person you ever saw on water skis.
That's right. Yes. Yes. It was incredible. It's right at the beginning. So, you know, today is, well, God, 70, 80 years later. So all the technology is so different. So it's hard even to describe it. But, you know, he sat on, you know, the steps that go down from a boat. Without that. So he's sitting on the edge there, and then the guy who was going to pull him along on the jet ski was looking back all the time. And then he sort of, and Errol Flynn sort of gave a kick on it, but with his head, et cetera, because in one hand he had a dachshund, a little baby dachshund. In the other hand, he was holding the thing. So, I watched it, you know, and I thought, well, how long is this going to last? This is going to be a disaster any minute. But then it turned around and came back, and then he gave a signal to the driver, and the driver just carried him on and dropped him. Brilliant. Where the steps were. And he didn't. He, all his bottom of his knees down were wet, but that's all.
Brilliant. Just one last one. Ian Fleming. I think your mum inspired the character Honeychild Ryder in Doctor No, and also Pussy Galore in Goldfinger. You must be immensely proud.
Well, they're two great titles, that's for sure.
They are. Well, look, I wanted to ask you first about the job you got working for Wurlitzer when you went back to England, and you were working, you went to school there, and then you came back to Jamaica and worked for Wurlitzer setting up jukeboxes in Jamaica. And you did all these extraordinary record buying trips to the US to stock them and selling records to sound systems. Was that what gave you a taste for wanting to try and, you know, popularize music that you liked, and maybe give you the idea of starting a record label?
I it must have been, really, because, you know, what was my biggest interest was music. And so if you're doing that, then, you know, you've got to try and find a way of making a living, you know, if that's really the thing you're most interested in. And that's kind of how I started. I went to somebody and suggested they do a record for me, because he sounded a lot like Brook Benton. His name was Wilfred Edwards.
Yeah.
And he was the first guy I recorded. And it went to the number one. And then the other people were Laurel Aitken went to number one, and another one was Owen Gray. They all went to number one. The records in Jamaica, and that was because you were now hearing Jamaicans singing songs. Before, you'd be hearing Winifred Atwell or great singers, etc., from America, etc., like that, or whatever was on radio in those days. So, but that's what really sort of kicked it in. And. And the people who really drove it were the sound system guys, were the guys who, you know, went around and went to open areas, huge open areas, and you couldn't put on the sound system, and the volume was unbelievable, you know. And
speakers hanging in the trees, I think you said in the book, yeah, isn't that right? That's right. Wonderful. Yeah. It's just a brilliant image. And when you started the label, I think in 1959, one of the first acts was a Bermudan jazz pianist called Lance Haywood, and he put out a record called Lance Haywood at the Half Moon Hotel, which actually you admitted was recorded in a studio. Genius. did you think he was a safe commercial bet to start your label with?
It was just something that came to me. What can I tell you? It was something like that. I mean, I wasn't drunk or anything. I might have had a couple of little drinks, but I wasn't sort of, you know, nuts. I loved the music that they played. These guys were from Bermuda. The lead singer, Lance Haywood, was blind. And, you know, there was just something about it, which I thought, my gosh, look what's happening here. Look what the music is. Music's good. The piano player's great. The guitar is great, etc. And, you know, that's their life. You know?
And you must have thought there was an international audience, or hoped there was, for people like the guitarist Ernest Ranglin, who you signed, didn't you, early on? And Laurel Aitken and Jimmy Cliff, who you mentioned earlier. I mean, they weren't, when you were putting those records out, they had no kind of profile abroad, did they?
Not initially.
The breakthrough in the UK, which I must ask you about, because it was so thrilling. I was, however old I would have been, 10, I think, when this record came out, was Millie's My Boy Lollipop. And I'm sure you get asked about it all the time, but it's just so interesting. It's a doo-wop song by a New York group, the Cadillacs. So how did you find that song, and why were you so convinced that it would work and work with her? Tell us the story of that.
Well, I found it gosh. I found it because it was one of the records that Coxon had sent to me in England.
Yeah.
It was Roy and Millie on one side of the record and Roy and Millie on the other side of the record. I can't remember what the other type one, but I'm not at all sure that My Boy Lollipop was on the A side. I'm not at all sure, but it might have been in Jamaica. So what they would do when they put together their records in Jamaica, they would send to me to distribute them to the Jamaican community in London. And that was, you know, the connection that I was getting from them backwards and forwards. So when I played the Millie record to friends of mine in England, they went nuts. I mean, they literally went nuts. They said, they would not leave my apartment unless I gave them the record. And it was...
Well, no one had heard anything like it, had they? It's a whole new, just a whole new backbeat.
That's right. No, that's right.
And that was, I mean, it was an enormous hit all over the world and kind of gave you the money to get the record label up and running. But there's a really interesting story where you go back to Jamaica with her and she's reunited with her mother and she's now come back to Jamaica as pretty much the most famous person, on the island. And you had very mixed feelings about that. Her mother just curtsied when she saw her, didn't she?
Yes. And in fact, it was, you know, firstly, when she arrived at the airport, there was a lot of people at the airport.
Yeah.
And that was the most people. And her mother wasn't at the airport. And the plan was, you know, soon as Millie's there, to get her in the car and get her to the hotel.
Yeah.
So they got her in the guitar, and on the way, all the way to the hotel along the road, people knew that was the way she was going. So people were cheering after her and things like that. I mean, not all along the road, like when Nelson Mandela or something came,
but yeah, yeah.
Pretty much that kind of thing. And so when she arrived at the hotel and came, and everybody was laughing and clapping and things like that. And she went up to her mum, and her mum curtsied to her, right? And I thought it was, I thought there was something really extraordinary about that. And I, and what sort of came up from it was a lot of difficulty for Millie to stay in Jamaica, because you know she'd become sort of another level, somebody never had anything like that before, you know. So that was it.
But you had kind of mixed feelings about how it had affected her life, hadn't you? Because you said after that you didn't want to be a pop Svengali, as you put it.
Yeah, well, definitely. It's somebody needing to be on stage, and then, you know, one time they can't be on stage because this has happened or that has happened or this has changed in their life or that. It's very, no, it's not something you want to.
No.
No.
Yeah. There's a great quote you put in from Tom Waits where he says, I've never had a hit single, but I've had a hit life, which I thought was a really good point. But I just want to ask you about back in Britain, one of your first signings was the Spencer Davis Group. And you were also the legal guardian for Steve Winwood, who was only 14, as you were to Millie, you know. But they, Spencer Davis Group, owe a lot of their success to Keep On Running and Somebody Help Me. And those were songs that you selected, didn't you? Composed by the Jamaican songwriter Jackie Edwards. Why did you choose those particular songs? Did you think they were just completely different to the characteristic of everything else that was happening in the charts in Britain at the time?
In a way, yes. It was something that somebody was doing from Jamaica.
Yeah.
And maybe the band could play it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
So it was, just... it was really from that, and they, and it is not a, a difficult music to play.
Yeah.
Once you're on it, you know, you kind of lock into it. So they, you know, it really became their record completely. But the original song and the original production was Wilfred Ed was around, Jimmy Cliff was around.
Yeah.
I had them around at the time. They recorded at Pi Studios.
It's a fantastic records, those. They're brilliant. I wanted to ask you about the moment where the kind of Ireland's rock catalogue started to take off, you know, and ask you about groups like Traffic and Nick Drake and Free. But there's a bit, again, in the book where you said that the label was characterised by underdogs, rejects and misfits. So that was wonderful. So why were those people so appealing? Was it that they were just likely to be more original?
Yes. More original, more original, but doing something a different way, looking to do something a different way, whatever, you know, coming up with something you haven't heard yet.
Yeah. So that was the kind of identity that you wanted the label to have?
Yes, and also the vibe of the person. That's really incredibly important. You know, and it's really important.
Yeah.
To know that that you know you're supported. If you put a record out, right, and you know, it can be that the people in charge of promotion can sometimes make a mistake, you know, yeah. And say they don't really feel this, and it didn't really happen, but it kind of happened somewhere else, you know. So that's kind of what I wanted to avoid in any of that area.
Well, one of the really pioneering things you seem to be doing was that a lot of other record labels were taking a very short-term view of the acts and wanting kind of instant return. And Traffic's a really good example. I mean, obviously, you had a great fondness for Steve and you'd had all that success with the Spencer Davis group. But you had this belief in Traffic where you're convinced that if you allowed them the time and you put them in the right creative space, they would invent a new kind of music. So how did you achieve that? Was that was the Aston Tyrol sort of episode, wasn't it? How did you achieve that? And what were you hoping that they were going to produce? What direction did you want them to go in?
Well, what you just described is really pretty close, you know, because it was something different, something exceptional. I mean, Steve Winwood, I mean, is a serious musician. I mean, he's unbelievable. You know, in keyboard, in guitar, you know, in vocal, his singing, you know, he's incredible, and so when that entered into my life, when I was looking around, still with Jamaicans, trying to, you know, get them happening in England. You know, a couple of them, like Jimmy Cliff, got involved. Jimmy Cliff got involved with a Cat Stevens record.
Yeah.
Later on, and you know, I was very happy about that. That it wasn't all just locked into one place. You know what I mean? And that's how you had to do it, because that's yeah.
So would Free have ever succeeded, do you think, if you hadn't? There's a moment where you convince them that you like All Right Now, but you've got to edit it down so that it's possible to play it on the radio. Was that the major turning point for them, do you think?
You mean up or down?
Oh, up. Because they suddenly had a hit, yeah. Didn't they?
Yes, a huge hit, I must say. But, you know, I love them. I was introduced to them in London, and the Wardour Street, there was a club in Wardour Street at the time, and I went to see them, and they were so powerful on stage. They were tiny, you know. One of them was kind of tallish, but the other two or three were tiny.
Tiny and incredibly young too, weren't they?
Yes, and they were great.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So I went to see them backstage and said, "Oh, come over to, you know, I'd love to come over to Island Records tomorrow. My office just across the street." So they came the next day, and they came in, and we talked about the music and what they'd be like and everything. And in the time that I talked with them, they didn't play any music, but they were talking, and I really signed them, because I knew they knew what they were wanting to, how they, you know, what they were wanting to do, and I felt that when that's the case, boy, you're almost there. You know, the problem is if you take on something and you haven't really found the right, you know, spot to be exposed. But when it suddenly comes to you, that's great.
Yeah,
and
wonderful.
That band had it. They had it, and they had it in confidence. I mean, they had absolute confidence. None of them had any doubt whatsoever that they were the best thing around.
And seemed to kind of achieve their potential. I wanted to ask you also about Nick Drake, because it must be so satisfying that he's finally got the reputation that he deserved. Were you involved in that whole business of trying to get him to do publicity and to, you know, to sell himself as a performer? Because the fact that he wasn't very good at either obviously really held him back. You know, was that frustrating?
Well, I believe, you know, I'm very grateful to Joe Boyd for him, because when Joe Boyd was managing him, then he had to go off to America. He was given a wonderful kind of job, and so he passed on to me Sandy Denny and Fairport Convention.
That's
and
right.
the different bands, one of whom was who we're talking about.
Yeah. Because so, any act is a balance between kind of talent and the appetite to succeed. So when you were signing acts, how much did their desire to sell themselves, how much was that a critical factor in making you want to sign them?
Well, in the case of the ones we were just talking about, in each of their cases, would be really focusing on what is a great song and a great, I mean, that was it. They came as musicians, so they needed to really, you know, have a great song and something special.
Well, were there any other labels that you were looking at that you considered to be rivals? You know, the others that were really adventurous and risk-taking, and you watched them closely? I mean, I was thinking of maybe Harvest or Charisma. I don't know. Did you think of those people as being on your patch?
I was never chasing that. because somebody signed to Virgin, you know, fortunately, I worked for myself so I could choose.
Yeah.
That, you know, I don't feel I'd be the best person for this act or we'd be the best person for this act, though I know somebody else is going to sign.
Yeah.
So, you know, or when I say somebody, in other words, I'm not saying because he's not talented, but because maybe somebody else gets what he wants to do.
There's a fantastic sequence about Bob Marley, which is it's so interesting. You're talking about the sound of Marley, who you've been working with for a long time, as being without a kind of international appeal. It was kind of reggae music, but it hadn't quite connected with the big potential white audience. So describe how you the changes that you felt should be made to his sound that would bring in a wider audience. And I think the role of Wayne Perkins, the guitarist, too.
I think just adding quote rock guitarists to the mix, and also, you know, acquiring, you know, really good musicians, all the way from, you know, all the different sides, from the different keyboard instruments to the shaking instruments, you know, everything like that. So Bob really picked that himself. I didn't have anything to do with that.
Yeah, because he was really, really ambitious and really open to suggestions, wasn't he, as to how to develop it?
Yes, definitely. No, when I first met him, he'd already been, there was Bob Marley and the Wailers. So that means he was sort of leading that brand, if you know what I mean. And that was from 10 years before, which I knew of him.
How difficult was that period when with Peter Tosh and Bunny Livingston, when they were leaving the group, and there was a certain amount of friction?
Well, it was just like what I've just described. It's not what they had was the three of them, and they were getting on pretty well. And they were, and they all were very much pushing their own music. Peter Tosh wrote great songs. Bunny Wailer wrote incredible songs. Bob Marley wrote great songs. So, you know, I just felt that Bob could really, if one put the, you know, guitar sound, American guitar sound into it, and another keyboard sound. In other words, just make it and enhance it just a very little bit without taking away any, you know, of the magic or whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
God, that must have been a thrilling moment to hear that come together in the studio. Incredible. But I was going to ask you about the various groups who you needed convincing to sign. I mean, one was Roxy Music, that you weren't at all keen on getting them on board, I think, until you saw the artwork of their first album. Was that right?
Yes. That's right.
And that's what swung it?
No, Tim Clark, who had been working with me for a long time at Island Records. And he'd been very keen on the band all the time. And it just wasn't my thing so much. I guess I was wanting a little bit more raunchy, rock and rollish or reggae-ish or something. Maybe And I felt that I didn't see how I could get that working out of, you know, working with that band who looked fantastic and ready, you know, just ready to be big stars pretty much instantly.
Yeah.
So that was really it.
What made you change your mind about U2? Because again, I think they'd been presented to you and you couldn't quite see it at first. Was there something that just that made you change your mind?
No, nothing was pushed at them to me before. Never heard any music of them before. I went into the club and saw them. I never saw it. People may have been sending to me, but I never got them because it's just, you know, it's not a way to me that I really want to go and hear a U2, a band which people are talking about and have some really great talent. So, you know, so I wanted to see them, looking forward to see them.
Yeah. And you talk about how when you have a band that big selling seven-figure quantities of records, that it's very easy to be less interested in the small-scale operators. But soon after that, you signed Tom Waits, and you know, was that because he was attracted to Ireland? Because, as you say, that you can't direct him, and that you didn't try and direct him, because that was a kind of mutual attraction between the two of you, wasn't it?
Well, Tom Waits, I love music. I can't play nothing. Yeah. I love music, right? And talent and music. And I just thought he was fantastic because he didn't sound like anybody else and didn't want to sound like anybody else. You know, he was just himself, you know, and that was it.
Did you get to hear any of those records he made in development and offer any opinion about them? Or did you just wait till the finished product was out?
It would have been, I'm not sure, but I would think in most instances it would be when Tom had finished with it.
Yeah. There's a bit where you talk about in the mid 80s at how that you felt that the label had become like any other label, but at that time you had the B-52s, you had Z Records, you know, Kid Creole and Christina, these fantastically fashionable New York acts, and you had later Frankie Goes to Hollywood. So at what point did you think you'd become kind of conventional, as it were?
Probably then.
It was then. Well, around the Frankie Goes to Hollywood time.
Well, Frankie Goes to Hollywood was another story, because that was just one of the most incredible records, you know, ever. It's just incredible. And Two Tribes, you know the one, Two Tribes?
No, they're just wonderful. Trevor Horn Productions. I think they're incredible records. They still sound fantastic today.
Well, you must play them, you know. They're incredible records. Well, he brought me in to come and listen to Two Tribes before, to see what I thought, and I'll never forget it. I could not believe how the sound, the impact of it was just incredible. And then, you know, that's why I really asked him to work with Grace.
That's right. They're extraordinary records. Those, you can hear all those kind of the jungle sounds in them. I mean, just there's so much in it. It's like a kind of sonic movie. They're revolutionary records, I think. So just a general question. At one point, you suggest that a lot of acts are mistrustful and suspicious about record deals, and always feeling that they should have made more out of them. Is that true? I mean, is it very hard for relations to end on a high note when you've signed someone to a record, your record label?
I don't think so. I'm trying to think, oh, anything which is difficult or anything, and that, I'm sure there must have been somewhere, but I can't think of it.
No, that's fine. You mentioned various groups that you failed to sign, and I wondered if you had any regrets about those. I suppose you probably don't. I think you turned down Procol Harum. I think you lost out trying to sign Led Zeppelin. You missed Dire Straits. I think you missed Madonna. But presumably those things you just shrug and just think, well, they're gone and there are other fish to fry.
Yes, well, it would be. If it was something that I really felt excited about and felt that I could contribute or do something about, I might have done that. But when I saw Madonna already knew exactly where she was going and how to get there, and I thought she was smart as could be right at that point in time. But you know, I loved what I was doing. You know what I mean? So I was really into, you know, the different acts we're working with and things like that. So I wasn't really out there trying to have, you know, instant hits or something like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Why did you sell Ireland then in 1989? What was the reason behind that? Why did you sell Ireland when you sold it?
Because it had got too much,
yeah,
too much, and I made mistakes, you know, and I was trying to remake The Harder They Come in Washington D.C.
Yeah,
and that cost me a lot of money, so I thought, you know, something. I think films and music are super important. But I don't think I have the skill for it, so I'm going to check out.
That's being impossibly modest. Was there were there any acts that you'd signed that you felt deserved more success that you think they just shouldn't have had it?
Yes.
Which ones in particular? Robert Palmer, maybe? I don't know. I'm just thinking.
Well, yes, Robert Palmer, because Robert Palmer is in the absolute top for me. His talent, everything about him, he was so smart, I can't tell you. And I got to know him very well, you know. I met him when he'd just run into a club to be lead singer for a band. And so after he sang, you know, I said hello, and then I reconnected with him, and then he was with that band, and then he left that band, and he started another band and left that band, and I kept in touch with him all the time. And then one day he said to me, came back and said he would really like to get, if I could record him in New Orleans. Or when they say record him, send the record. Do it in New Orleans. And I said, oh, I love that idea, absolutely. So that's what I did. So he made his first records, Sneaking Sally Through the Alley.
And that fantastic records. The bit in the book where you see him coming into the club the first time, you describe that in incredible detail. It's him, I think, and his girlfriend, and just the whole place turns to look at them because they're so fantastically, impossibly gorgeous. It's a fantastic bit of writing. But was there a particular, I mean, it's really hard to tell with all these different decades, but was there a particular golden era, do you think, for you? One particular time you thought was just particularly rich?
Well, obviously there was a time when everything was working at its best, and that never lasts too long. Without, you know, it has to change one way or another. But if I were to take it, there was the period when Bob Marley was, you know, playing festivals around the world or shows around the world. U2 was doing the same. Cat Stevens was still, you know, selling millions and millions of records, doing big shows. And etc., you know, two or three which I can't think of immediately, who were on the road. Well, Sly and Robbie, you know, things like that, Black Uhuru.
Well, it's a fantastic life, Chris, and it's an extraordinary story, and it's a wonderful book. It's really colourful and really unusual insights into a huge chunk of so many people's record collections, particularly mine. So thanks so much for talking to us. And yeah, My Life and Music and Beyond by Chris Blackmore is out on Bonnier Books, and I couldn't be more enthusiastically recommended. Thanks so much, Chris. Brilliant to talk to you.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.